From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Pahom. Fiji's Meteorological Service says Nadi and the southwest of Vita Levu have escaped the worst effects of Cyclone Kenny. The service's director, Ravindra Kumar, says the Category 3 system changed direction and sped up towards the southeast. According to him, this meant the strongest hurricane force winds were over water and didn't make landfall on Vita Levu. However, Mr. Kumar says Cyclone Kenny was forecast to hit Kavuta directly on its new path, bringing strong winds and enough to uproot trees and damage infrastructure. And this is exactly what happened. Luke Kerchevolt, one of Australia's owners of the Matavai Resort on Kadavu, described to Karori Hawkins shortly after the cyclone hit.
It just came out of nowhere this time. We've got quite a large boat's capsized. We couldn't get it to shelter quick enough. We've had a number of huge mango trees come down on a lot of our buildings. But most importantly, the villagers, they're really struggling. A lot of the villagers have lost their houses completely. We've got a small village next to us who've had to do a walk around the mountain to get to us for shelter because they've lost everything where they are. And so it was pretty full on. I'm not sure where it's headed next because we've kind of lost most of our communication. So we've got no internet or anything like that at the moment. But we hope that we can get cleaned up pretty quick and kind of head into the village and help them out when they need it.
And it sounds like has it calmed down now? Is that what, or are you inside a building?
No, it looks like it might be the kind of middle of it, the eye of it. We're just waiting to see what happens.
I guess I'll just ask a little bit more about the villagers who came around. What have they told you about their side of the island?
It looks like one of the villages, which is Kandavakoru, has been completely flooded, and a number of our staff are from that village. So they've had to kind of run back to along the track to get home to try and help. One of the smaller villages called Sirocco, which is to our west, got hit at the same time. Their whole family is now, including children, they're kind of a settlement rather than a village.
Yeah.
Their entire family is now holed up in our... So we're fortunate on our hill we have two homes that are made of concrete block.
Yeah.
But all of our bull rays are kind of traditional.
Yeah.
And we've got them holed up there at the moment, and we're just slowly starting to try and cut pathways through all the vegetation now.
Yeah.
Back down to the main bull ray.
Your bull rays survived? Have they survived okay? Or
No, we will have lost a couple of those, and also all of our dive shops have been wiped out by the mango tree.
Oh my goodness.
Probably the biggest mango tree I've ever seen, which is, you know, great under normal circumstances, but it's fallen and taken out two of our buildings, which unfortunately house our air compressor and our generator and all of our dive gear, which is probably the worst thing for it to fall on. And so then so there's that, and another tree's come down on some of the other buildings. But
is everybody safe in your organization?
Yeah. No. Yeah, they are. Yep, no, they are. And we have a few guests at the moment. And then they were, you know, everyone moved quickly to get them up to the house, and that's all fine for now. And we've got food at the moment. We've got a small backup generator, like on wheels, which we can run fridges and freezers off to keep things cold over the next day or two, and hopefully we can, get things cleaned up. So,
it's pretty sad.
It's a difficult place, especially when no one can offer cyclone insurance for this type of event. But we've kind of, our boat's a bit of a killer, having that capsized, which is one of our dive boats.
Oh, gutted to hear that, mate. That's really, really sad.
It's unfortunate. We'll rebuild and whatnot. We're actually a bit more concerned about the village at the moment. I think during Gita it kind of hit, but it didn't make landfall on us.
Yeah.
And so even then the village, you know, we didn't notice it. It was heavy wind, heavy rain overnight. But as a resort, we didn't notice it. But the village certainly did. And if they noticed that, then, you know, we're dread to go into the village and see what's actually happened.
Sodden conditions have become the new normal for families in Fiji's west. Torrential rains off the back of a tropical depression and two cyclones in as many weeks have caused major flooding. As many as 15,000 people are still living in 280 evacuation centers in the country's west following the latest cyclone Kenny. As of the recording of this program, Sally Round spoke to Dominic Godfrey about the cleanup, which is just getting underway.
For many people who found their homes flooded for another time, you know, they've had two cyclones in just over a week here and a huge amount of rain due to another weather system that passed through in between. So they have been cleaning up their homes. They're taking advantage of a fine day here after the cyclone passed through yesterday. I went to see a village that was just a sea of mud, really. And in fact, one of the ministers had just been to visit it because there had obviously been ongoing complaints about this place where drains are just blocked constantly. And the people were just sort of tiptoeing around trying to get their furniture dry by putting it up on the roofs. You know, some of these homes have been built up so that, you know, they're so used to the flooding now that they've actually added rooms on top.
So this is the new normal for them in the west, I guess, of Viti Levu.
Yeah, that's what quite a few people were saying to me today. I went to an evacuation centre and a woman said, oh, you know, we often come here, this is where we go. And she comes with her five children and three grandchildren, and they camp out on a mattress in the corner of the evacuation centre at the Salvation Army building, not far from the centre of Nandi. And, you know, there's quite a cheerful atmosphere. All the kids are playing volleyball and the parents and other family members cooking in the kitchen. And it seems like a great gathering point, but they're using this time as respite to get back down into their homes to give them a good clean out. They're given about 3 days, really, to get back on their feet after a flooding event like this, and 3 days' worth of food and supplies, and then back into their homes.
So those 3 days' worth of supplies are from the evacuation centres?
Yes, they're sort of donated supplies, supplied by people, by the government, and, of course, volunteer groups like the Red Cross. And the Red Cross showed me some of the packs that they've been handing out, and they're really down to the bare bones now. They've got a container. I'm just standing outside it now, actually, in Nandi. And it's sort of been emptying out pretty quickly with all the events that have been going on. And they're just waiting to be stocked up again. You know, when you talk about the new normal, Dominic, one of the interesting things I learned today was how a couple of families have invented these systems where they have ropes and they pull their furniture up to the top of the ceiling so that they can keep things dry. And then the floodwaters come in and they know where the floodwaters come up to, and then they go out again and they bring the furniture down.
What is the ground like? I mean, it's been so sodden for so long. Give us a sense of what it's like to wade through this land for these people.
Well, it's just sloppy mud, really. You know, just you really need your gumboots. And, yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's way worse further north where I'll be heading to in the next few days. Bar apparently is in a really bad state, and around the Rakiraki, which the town centre is being closed. So I'll get to see a lot more sodden places further north.
That was Sally Round speaking to Dominic Godfrey. Vanuatu's foreign minister says his government can play more of a role in bringing its various aid partners together for a more effective development result. Ralph Rengenvu's comments follow Australian media speculation that China is looking to establish a military base in Vanuatu. The foreign minister has denied such a plan is ever being discussed between his government and Beijing, underlining that China is one of a range of development partners for his country. The minister told Johnny Blaze that Vanuatu remains strongly opposed to militarization.
Vanuatu is a country with a long history, similar to New Zealand, of being opposed to nuclear arms, of being opposed to armament. We're a long-time member of the Nuclear Free Independent Pacific Movement, one of the strongest countries for that. From the beginning, we've just voted in support of the new resolution against nuclear arms that just passed in the UN General Assembly last year. We're a member of the Non-Aligned Movement. I've just come back from the meeting. Our whole history has been one of not being and getting involved in militarization of any sort. And so any suggestion that we put a military base in our country to make ourselves the target of possible nuclear attack, I mean, that's just crazy.
The Prime Minister, Xiahlo Salwai, was, though, the first leader of a Pacific country to voice support for China's military expansion in the South China Sea, wasn't he?
It wasn't support for military expansion. It was support for the principle that they used to claim that they had territorial rights over that area of the sea. What he said was that it was similar to the way in which we sorted out our waterway sovereigns, which was on the basis of cultural and historic ties rather than on invention of the law of the sea.
Much of this angsting going on after the Fairfax reports in Australia seems to be about just about Australia's interests, the Western metropolitan powers. How about Vanuatu's view of all this in terms of China's rising influence in our region? Is that such a bad thing?
Well, China is the latest big boy in the region. It's a role that's been previously enjoyed by Britain, France, Australia, to a certain extent New Zealand, although New Zealand has always been sort of seen as being under Australia, like we are. I think this is a further chapter in the history of the Pacific. And as Pacific Islanders, we have seen these waves come, and they keep coming. And in the future, maybe there'll be someone else. We just need to make sure that we in the Pacific can maintain and assert our sovereignty or decide what we want for ourselves, and that's really the point.
Vanuatu has a range of partners, aid partners included. How does China rate among that? Is it a good partner who listens to what the people of Vanuatu and its government need?
Well, in terms of quantity of aid, just simply in those terms, Australia is still the largest partner of Vanuatu. China's probably second or third, I'm not sure. China specifically provides infrastructure projects, which is something which makes them a bit different to Australia and New Zealand, who traditionally have not done that. I think that's a niche that they're filling right now. It's a niche that is one that is particularly felt to be in need of Vanuatu. We need certain infrastructure that it's very difficult to get otherwise. You have to spend a lot of money and get a loan for, and a lot of the time China comes in and offers to build this infrastructure at no cost. So obviously it's a very attractive offer for a country like Vanuatu.
Can't all the partners get along? And let's say, isn't there scope for everyone working together in common interests in this region?
Yes, I think there's more of a role for the Vanuatu government to try and bring our partners to talk around the one table. And I think that's a lesson that we've learned from this whole thing. We need to be more proactive in making sure that we get our partners to talk to each other when, in some instances, they perhaps don't. Seems to be the case between Australia and China. I know that Australia and New Zealand talk to each other a lot. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to extend also to China, but I think it's our job as a Vanuatu government to make sure that we get all our partners talking together and cooperating together and making development in Vanuatu more effective as a result. We should be the ones taking the lead, and I think that's something that we will have to step up on as a result of some of these, as far as you can say, media conflicts that have arisen in recent months, especially between Australia and China.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A French Polynesian woman has been advised by the French authorities in Tahiti not to challenge Chinese diplomats occupying her mother's property illegally. The rent contract of the Chinese consulate in Tahiti expired at the end of February, but the mission remains occupied. Walter Zeifel reports.
A social media campaign has been launched in an attempt to coerce China to recognize property rights in force in French Polynesia. Neither the French High Commission nor the Chinese consulate has responded to last week's inquiries by RNZ Pacific about whether the diplomatic status confers China's representatives a right to remain in residence China. And during office hours, the consulate's phone went unanswered. At the end of last week, Eva Biton, the owner's daughter, had a meeting with the French High Commissioner René Vidal to ask for assistance.
He said that no judge and no court would ever receive the consulate of China and the Chinese diplomat to treat this affair, this case.
She said he advised her to back off and, according to her, he suggested the residence be sold as desired by China. But the house is not for sale. To try to recover the house, her lawyer told her that going to court remained an option, contrary to the advice by the High Commissioner, albeit it is one involving some risks.
Maybe the court could give them 2 years or 10 years, we don't know. So my lawyer says better to make a protocol to have an occupation fee, and maybe they stay only for a few months.
In March, police summoned her to the station and she was questioned about graffiti on the Chinese consulate wall. Mrs. Piton said a Secret Service agent had told her about the graffiti the day before she was summoned. Although she said it was an informal chat at the police station, she was warned that they could seize all her computers and devices to get at her data. She says she is bewildered by the situation she and her mother have found themselves in.
I have a lot of fear about all this because the police and because of what René Bidal told me, because he insisted about the protection of China consulate and Chinese diplomats, and I told him, as I was victim of aggressivity there, who is going to protect me? I'm a citizen, I have civic rights with protection.
The French Polynesian government said it was a private dispute between a landlord and a tenant and it cannot intervene in the affairs strictly in the competence of China. Eva Biton is now turning to Paris, writing to President Emmanuel Macron as well as the Foreign Ministry and the Justice Ministry. This is Walter Zweifel.
The New Zealand government is close to giving its Pacific Realm countries, Niue, the Cook Islands and Tokelau, the access to the superannuation that they have been seeking for some years. Legislation is now before Parliament, which will end the requirement for people from the island countries to have spent 5 years after the age of 50 in New Zealand to qualify. The island's countries have been pushing for this because they believe it'll help build their economies with people returning much earlier than present. Don Wiseman spoke to the Minister of Social Development, Carmen Sapaglioni, about the legislation and some recent concerns raised by NIO's leader, who have called for no restrictions at all on the qualifications for superannuation. He began by asking the Minister how far the legislation was from becoming law.
Our commitment is making sure that it goes through before January 2019, and given that we've got support across the House, then I have no doubt that we'll be able to meet that commitment.
The government's received a message this week from the Premier of Niue withdrawing his support for the changes because he effectively wants this to push further still. His main concern, I think, is that New Zealand has two classes of citizenship. He thinks there shouldn't be any restrictions at all on people in the islands. If they are New Zealand citizens, they should get what other New Zealand citizens get, which is super, once they hit 65. What is your view on that?
I guess slightly surprised because Premier Tokitalangi, alongside Prime Minister of the Cook Islands, Henry Puna, presented to the Select Committee, I think in 2015, in support of this portability arrangement. I know that the Premier of Niue, Tokitalangi, wanted to extend that. He did raise that when we were on the Pacific Mission as well. But this is the point that we're at. And after he raised the idea that Niue and the other realm countries might get access to full superannuation even if they hadn't lived in New Zealand or worked in New Zealand, you know, we did come back. I did look at the legislation around this. And I think it's really important to note that the legislation is very clear that the residents of the Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau, are not New Zealand residents, even though they reside in the realm of New Zealand. And as part of that arrangement, there's no expectation that realm citizens living in realm countries pay taxes to the New Zealand government. And therefore, as part of that, the fact that they don't pay taxes, then they're also not covered by the New Zealand social security system. And that's really clearly outlined in the legislation. So the point that we've got to now in terms of portability and ensuring that realm country citizens don't have to stay between the age of 50 and 65 and they go back to contribute to their realm countries, they can go back, I think is a really good arrangement. And, you know, originally Tokitalangi was right behind it. Henry Puna still is. He was there to listen to the full first reading in the House. And so hopefully we can continue these discussions.
Just look at one aspect. For adults coming from the islands, they have to spend 10 years in New Zealand to qualify. That 10 years can be what? Any time between the age of 20 and 50?
Absolutely.
So they could work from the age of 20 to the age of 30, go back at the age of 30, and then they would qualify at 65 if that's still the age.
If they're still living in a realm country from the age of 50 to 65 for the 5 years? Absolutely. So we don't want to in any way stop people from being able to contribute to our realm country nations, and we absolutely respect the economic and social contribution that they have to make. I guess it's just aligning our support for that with also the conditions of our own legislation, which does clearly outline that in order to be eligible for social security in New Zealand, then you have to have been resident and paid New Zealand taxes. And so that's where the differential is, I think.
Yes, there is this question within that, though, of two classes of New Zealand citizenship, and that remains.
Well, I think the legislation outlines really clearly that despite the fact that you may be a resident of the realm of New Zealand, you're not a resident of New Zealand necessarily unless you live in New Zealand. And so that 10-year rule still stands, and I think it's very fair. I mean, there's no expectation and there's no consideration of this to be an expectation that any of our realm countries pay taxes to New Zealand. And so as it stands, the legislation states that when you pay taxes to New Zealand, then for that certain period of time, then you get access to the social security system, which is funded by New Zealand taxpayers. And so that's where the distinction is made.
The fight to ban child brides in American Samoa is not over. A lawmaker in the U.S. territory recently introduced a bill to increase the age of young women that can marry from the age of 14 to 18. However, the bill was knocked back in its final reading in the Senate. Supporters are aiming to get it back on the table. Dominic Godfrey has the story.
Representative Fialupe Fiawilutu's bill received strong support in the House, but faltered at its third reading in the Senate, 9-7. One of those who voted against the bill was the acting Senate President. Nuanuau Lefingainga Sauluanganua says his concern, and that of other senators, is for young women who become pregnant and would no longer be allowed to marry.
There was a law before us a long time that 14, 15, 16 and 17 years old, they are not married until the consensus from both a father and a mother wants their kids to get wet.
The age where people are considered legally competent to consent to sexual acts is 16 in the territory, yet girls as young as 14 are currently allowed to marry. For men, the marriage age is 18. The bill aims for gender equality while recognising the developmental needs of young women. The Territory's Chief Legislative Counsel, Nathaniel Savali, says Fialupe aims to reintroduce her bill in the next session of the whānau.
In the July session, the rules for the House as well as the Senate does not allow her to reintroduce it in the same session that it was rejected.
Mr. Savali says the whānau has been receiving a lot of feedback via social media in support of the bill, some quite angry that it wasn't passed into law. The women's advocacy group, Ai Ma'auli, says the Senate did not have a thorough enough look at the bill before rejecting it. Its president, Leitaua Leunga Turner, wants to ensure the bill is reintroduced with significant public education and feedback. Leitaua says Ai Ma'auli is organising a survey to establish public opinion, and she says they'll work with children's advocates to bring together data on what's best for girls and young women.
And then should this bill be introduced, we would like to be part of that development by sharing the information from this survey and also to get people who are knowledgeable of child development an opportunity to assist.
Leitaua Leunga Turner says all the information would be incorporated and offered to the whānau for its consideration. The Senate's acting president, Nuanuau Lefengainga, says he'd support a well-informed reintroduction of the bill.
When this comes before us by July, I think we have to look very closely with that. We want to see some statistics, not only American Samoa, but the Pacific one.
To the west, in neighbouring Samoa, men must be 21 and women 19 to marry without parental consent. The Territory's Chief Legislative Counsel, Nathaniel Savali, says Fialupe was previously the Chief Clerk of the House and over her 20 years has seen others attempt to pass similar legislation.
She's very passionate about her role as a representative as well as championing women and children issues that affect them.
He says this is Fialupe's first bill
and she's very determined. This is Dominic Godfrey.
And with that story from Dominic Godfrey, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. Also, let us know how you heard the program or follow PCJ Radio International on Facebook and Twitter. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye. Thank you.